Hello, and welcome to another episode of the How to Scale a Business podcast. My name is Hector Santia-Esteban, and I am your host for today. Our special guest is Mr. Adam Wakeling. He's the host of the Product Development Podcast and a product manager at Shepherd Media. And we're going to talk about how leaders should be thinking about the product development process from someone who's in it as well. Adam, thanks for hanging out with us today.
It's great to be here, Hector. Thank you for being here.
Give us a little bit about your background and catch us up. You've been doing this for over a decade. You've been in this kind of field for a while. Talk to us about how you got into here and then a little bit about what you're doing now.
Yeah, sure. So I started my journey, I suppose, in product over a decade ago. I started as a copy editor at a publisher called Shepherd. Still there today, but in a different capacity. Yeah, back then, I was essentially working on print magazines and handbooks. So we would have journalists creating the articles, send them out to the, create the magazines, then essentially sell advertising around the publications, distribute them at trade shows. And that was our main source of revenue. So that obviously wasn't very digitally focused. We had that print background. We, at one time, were just print only. We didn't really have the digital publications. At the time, there was this big digital transformation. 10 years ago, the publishers were all scared or excited, depending on how they viewed things. And I think there's definitely a parallel between how people were reacting in the publishing industry back then as many people are reacting today to AI. So I kind of see that parallel, just on the AI is obviously on a much grander scale. So in terms of my own journey, going from that sort of foundation of print, we ended up becoming print first, and then we embraced some digital products, some digital publications. That led to becoming digital first, so still doing print products, but having the sort of digital first workflows in our production process. And then eventually, bring it forward to the last few years, and we went to digital only. So that was the publication side. Part of that journey was also taking a lot of that data that we had in these publications and creating a SaaS product out of it. A lot of lessons along the way. This was a 0-to-1 product originally in print format, and all the trials and tribulations of taking that data, digitizing it. And this was the time before you can just upload a load of Word documents to ChatGPT and get it to say, normalize this data for you and structure it in this way. It was a very different time back then. So a lot less friction these days, but that's kind of where we get to now in terms of our SaaS product, which is essentially an opportunity finding tool for the defense industry. So if you're a company, you're interested in trying to find opportunities in the market, government contracts, that sort of thing, it's very difficult to particularly anticipate that sort of thing in terms of forecasts. So we provide a tool to be able to access our data, access the information from our analysts, and in a very connected, I suppose, format in terms of they can go in, all the data, no matter whether it's equipment profiles or programs, it's all from the same relational database, which makes it a very connected user experience. And that's kind of one of our big unique selling points over the years, a connected data experience that's very easy to use and provides opportunities for the market. So worked very closely with the CEO and then our CEO to deliver that to what it is today.
It's fascinating because I think there's so many parallels to what we're going through today, like you said, with AI. But I'm curious, was it a big pivot or was it a natural progression when you guys are all of a sudden, you went from digital or you went from print to digital to SaaS? Was all that a natural progression or did you make any detours along the way?
Yeah, I suppose the detours were kind of the functionality that we explored and executed too quickly before we properly validated them. And I think we definitely some lessons which I can share in due course, but it was a pretty incremental process. The early days in terms of embracing digital was essentially replicating the print experience. So here's a digital publication, let's put it into a page turner. And back in the early days, it was, flash-based experiences where you would turn the page, it would make the swish sounds as you turn the page. And that was the height of technology back then. But obviously then people then converted it to HTML5 experiences. A lot of people then tried to replicate a kind of website experience for their publications. And I think it's been a challenge for particularly magazines over the years to try and create a digital experience which matches the physical experience of reading a magazine, a print magazine. But it's just always fallen short. And I think part of the reason for that is trying to recreate an experience in the physical world within the digital world. So give you a brief example, particularly on the advertising side. Typically, the outside back cover is the prime slot in print publications for advertising real estate. In a digital publication, it's essentially the last page you get to before scrolling through all the content. So it's a very different thing. Needs are different. People use these things very differently. So that was a big challenge. And I think we started to de-emphasize the publications piece of the business when we realized that there was way more opportunity, way more monetization potential in taking our data and doing a lot more with it, creating a subscription model to that data, because there is a certain ceiling in terms of advertising sales, you know, distribution, how many you print, etc. So yeah, this made it a lot more scalable option in terms of monetization opportunities for what we did.
So it seems like you had these sort of resources, or you had this sort of data all the whole time, but then obviously as technology advanced, you just found a way to, I don't want to say repurpose it, or retool it is a better way to say it. That's kind of how that progression came about, is that it was, you know, resources or assets that you had already acquired and just utilizing them in a different way.
Yeah, I think one, you know, to the credit of our CEO at the time, Darren Lake, he was very much trying to solve problems, and we stayed in that product discovery and problem space enough to be able to validate what the solution eventually became. And then what I mean by that is we explored what the underserved needs in the industry. You know, we had the data, but how do we want to present it? I mean, we don't want to get too caught up in the, oh, I've got an idea of we could do this portal which does this thing or does that thing. We looked at it and said, okay, what does the market provide? There are some companies which provide similar data, but it's stovepiped. It's all the different industries that are very difficult to connect together, whether it's you're looking at the air side, the land side, the naval side. So we created, particularly the CEO at the time, had the vision for this single relational data set where everything can be connected. If you want to compare a helicopter to a radar system, it's all possible due to the nature of this single database, which is all connected. So that was a big part of it. It was, okay, what problems are there? Well, the connectability of data, a quick and easy way to get access to this data in a reasonably cost-effective way, because a lot of the other solutions were very expensive at the time as well. So that was a big impetus for it. So we had those problem statements, we went to the market, validated that, and then said, okay, how can we build this out to solve these problems? And I think that's a really important part of product development. And I think if I was going to speak to business owners and sort of new founders, I'd say, make sure you spend enough time in the product discovery problem space before you get too excited and build away and create something which either people don't really care about, or they might care about, but it's not monetizable. So I think that's the key takeaway from that.
I think it's also important for people who are listening, and they may be making this assumption already, but that they may not be developing a SaaS product. You know, a lot of our listeners might have a service-based business or maybe even a physical product. I think that the product development process can be approached, at least from a high level, at least in the stages or the main focuses, in the same way. And that there are this discovery process that you're talking about can be beneficial or important regardless of whether or not you're building a SaaS product.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it can apply to physical products, it can apply to SaaS tools, as you said. A great framework, which I like to refer to, and I spoke to actually the author of this on the podcast recently, a guy called Dan Olson. And he wrote a book called The Lean Product Playbook. And in that playbook, he essentially guides the reader through a pyramid, and it's the product market fit pyramid. So at the very bottom, you've got your target customer, you know, what's their demographics, psychographics, behavioral characteristics, all this stuff. Then you're exploring the underserved needs. So what are the underserved needs which you can tap into for those particular personas? At that point, you can kind of go into the product space a bit more, away from the market, and think about a value proposition to meet those underserved needs, build a feature set on top of that, and then think about the user experience of that. And you can apply that to, as I said, physical products, SaaS tools, a website design, whatever else. So I think that framework is pretty universal. And thinking over the last 10 years in terms of digital transformation efforts and the publishing world, that still applies today as it was when he first wrote that in 2016. Nothing has really changed fundamentally about the way we think, the way we act. There are technological layers on top of that. But fundamentally, you know, in terms of product development, they're tried and tested ways which are very much applicable today as they were, you know, 2016, 2015 when he came up with that framework.
In this discovery process, are there mistakes that you see a lot of business owners who are going through this? I mean, outside of just skipping it altogether, for the ones who are doing it, are there mistakes that you're seeing that are avoidable?
Yeah, I think a common one is, I mean, there's a few kind of terms in product development. One is the risk of having a hippo in the organization, you know, the person who gets paid the most, and they're the kind of voice of authority in what they say you do. And that's kind of a risk of a business owner maybe having an ego or something like that and not being guided by what products are recommending to them. So that's a big part of it. I think also thinking about how confident you are in the things that you are thinking you should deliver. So there's a classic prioritization framework called RICE or ICE, depending on how you want to score it. So impact, effort or ease, and confidence. And I think confidence is a really crucial one. Again, to reference another person I spoke to, Itamar Galad, who wrote a book called Evidence Guided. He came up with the confidence calculator, which a lot of product teams use and which I'd recommend, if you haven't heard of it, to check it out. It's essentially, here's your idea, but how confident are you that idea will affect that the metric you're interested in changing is going to change? So what that might look like is at the very bottom of the rating score out of 10, you have self-conviction. I think it's a good idea. And that is the lowest possible score because it's a completely assumption-led. There's no real evidence there. It's just, well, maybe I've seen this before and I think it's a good idea. Again, kind of taking that ego away as a product manager, I like to think of, you know, my ideas are informed and, you know, are good, but I have to challenge myself not to let that self-conviction, you know, overcome the lack of evidence. But moving up the scale, you kind of go through the different options. So, okay, is there market research on this? Are there customers saying that they would like this? Have you done some experimentation, some A-B testing work to validate this idea? And obviously that can be many forms. So it could be, I've created a landing page with this kind of messaging of what this thing we're trying to do. Let's put it to market. And if people click the link to say, I'm interested, you can start validating that interest through that way. Backdoor testing. There's also, I suppose, more proactive Wizard of Oz testing where you can kind of create a very manual prototype of what you're trying to do. And you can test people. But really this automated experience that you're providing really is just someone in the background doing some manual work to give the illusion that it's a fully functional product. So many different ways to validate that side. But as I said at the beginning, I think spending enough time in this product discovery and validation piece is really crucial, because if you rush into execution too quickly, you could spend a lot of money, time, resources, effort building something which is not the right thing to build.
Yeah. When we get back from break, Adam, I want to talk about the rest of the parts of this process, because like I said, I think this is applicable to everybody. And I don't think that enough business owners outside of the SaaS world look at their products or service in a from a product development lens. And so we're going to get into that and more of it right after this quick break. Hey, y'all. Today's episode is brought to you by Amplify Media, and we are a podcast and content creation company. Well, we like to think of ourselves as a platform building company, because chances are you probably have a product, a passion, a mission, a message, something that you want to get out to the world, but you might not have the time, the team, or the tech skills to do it. If that's the case, we can help. Go to amplifymedia.com. That's AMPLAFY media.com. You can also check the show notes for info. And with that, let's get back to Adam. Okay, Adam. So we talked about what I would imagine is the first stage, and there are some, you know, a few parts to that. Talk to us about the rest of the product development process. Are there some general stages that kind of outline it?
Yeah. So, I mean, pretty much, I think Dan Olson's pyramid is a really great way to think about the product market fit piece. I think from my perspective, once you get that validation, you can start thinking about prioritization. Obviously, early stage founders may not have a dedicated product manager yet. Often, they are the kind of acting product manager at that point, and it might be one of the early hires in the process. But I would recommend getting a product manager as early as you can in the process of building out a product, depending what it might be. I think that there is unique perspectives that a product manager brings, and it's all about really building the right thing at the right time for the right people. And yeah, sense checking the market and how confident you are in doing those things. So back to that confidence piece with Itamar Galad and his confidence meter. I think there are a couple of things which I would like to touch on, which is that there is a risk in the early stages, particularly being a feature factory for sales, because particularly when the money isn't readily coming in, you feel like there are maybe requests from, you know, to close a deal from the sales team or whatever else. And sometimes that's a great thing to do. But from the product perspective, I think you're at risk of maybe veering away from the value proposition of what you're trying to achieve with the product and as a business. So it's fine to deliver some expectations for the sales, maybe close a couple of deals, but don't let that be the overwhelming majority of what you're doing in terms of product development, because it's all too easy to take the money for the short term, but for the long term, you might sacrifice the integrity of the product, maybe even the scalability of the product. You know, this is the How to Scale a Business podcast, and it's very easy to get carried away with sales requests, and then you get to a place where suddenly you realize, wow, actually all these things have meant that the infrastructure is convoluted, it's complex, we've done things which we shouldn't have done, therefore that's going to cause more issues later on. And I think particularly, you know, on a data product, which is mainly my experience, if you don't keep the foundations robust and consistent, it's very easy to create scaling issues later on.
Yeah. Do you have any examples of when that's gone wrong? Or can you think of a time when that may have not played out? Because I feel like I've seen that happen in our business, where we do one-offs or for a certain client, we change the scope of it and we start doing these things that we aren't in our, you know, zone of genius, frankly. They're not in our wheelhouse. And almost to a T, it doesn't work out. So have you seen that on your end as well?
Yeah, absolutely. We had a few examples. I mean, I won't get into too many details for obvious reasons, certain clients, et cetera. But one example springs to mind, and that's hedge funds. They're not our core target market, but we had a number of conversations with potential clients around the hedge funds. And they have a very specific set of user needs compared to our typical user. So we spent a long time and effort thinking about how we can meet their user needs, which again, wasn't our core market. It wasn't our target market aligned to the value proposition of what we're trying to do going into the financial market. So we ended up spending a lot of time, a lot of my time, thinking about how we could meet their needs. We built out certain things in terms of what they wanted. We ended up building an automated tool to give them certain information they needed. And it turned out actually, it really wasn't what they needed. And it's a classic example of also going and building what someone says that they need, instead of asking why enough times to understand actually, why is that important? And then diving deeper, and in the words of Dan Olson again, kind of peeling back the onion on those layers to understand what the deep needs are, which we can then formalize into a solution. So yeah, a couple of lessons from that. One was not taking things for face value in terms of what customer needs are when you get feedback from them. But also, back to my other point, being true to your target market, is this a core market that you want to scale into? If it isn't, then maybe if you get distracted by this other segment, then you're going to be to the detriment of other segments as well. I assume most people aren't listening, or they're not part of Google and the FANG, you know, with all this abundant money to pour into product development. So it can be, yeah, life or death of an early stage startup if you build the wrong thing. So that's one example. Another example I can think of was we built out this beta functionality for essentially an extra tool to provide aggregated data in a sort of different way than we did already. And this was based on some pieces of customer feedback. Generally, we thought it was a good idea, so we went ahead and started to build it. The problem is we didn't get enough validation from other users, but also internally and understanding the implications of what that would be. So for us, what we found fundamentally, the data we wanted to try and convey to people, the data we had in the system didn't allow us to provide the aggregated data in a way that they needed. So we ended up building it. And in the actual beta prototype that we had, which we spent a lot of development time to build it, we realized the data was just not there. Like, you know, we looked at it, it was inconsistent. It wasn't, the data quality was not high enough to the point that we'd be happy to deliver that to the market. So we ended up saying, okay, let's pause this, revisit later on when the data is good enough in the ways that we wanted to present it to bring it back to the market. So honestly, I think if we spent more time in the product discovery phase and exploring the problem space and understanding what people wanted and also correlating that to the limitations of what we had in terms of the database, I think that would have prevented a lot of the extra work that we put into it. Don't jump ahead too quickly is the lesson there.
Yeah, it's a great point, because I think so many business owners, they have this product or service or, you know, app or whatever it is that they've built, and they just try and force that down the throat of the customer, no matter what their interests or needs are. Or to your other point, they swing hard the other way and try and make it something for everybody by adding one feature for this person and another feature for this person. And they end up being, you know, something for nobody, or ends up being this kind of jack of all sort of trades that isn't really great at anything. And I think too many business owners, and I just know because I've swung on both ends of those spectrums, fall into that category.
Yeah, I think particularly early on, starting small, having a very focused target market, and then later on thinking about expanding that to other markets or other target personas. I think, yeah, focusing on a particular niche is the best way to think about scaling. As much as it would be great to think, oh, this is going to apply to all millennials or all this demographic, which is huge, I think you really need to hone in on that profile. And later on, you can expand that out, but I think be true to that target market that you're trying to meet the underserved needs on.
And it also speaks to the fact that you want to get feedback from the right types of people. I've seen business owners get feedback from people who don't fit their target market, who aren't in the right audience, and end up making decisions that don't resonate with their target market, don't resonate with their audience, and then they're wondering why people aren't buying or why people aren't doing whatever it is that they're hoping their customers are doing. but it's because they got feedback from, in the instance that I'm thinking about, someone who is perhaps opposite of their target market. And that's why, you know, it impacted the results.
Yeah, but be wary of anonymous research and feedback for sure. If you need to align that to your segments for sure. Just on the feedback point, actually, I'd like to just mention something that's quite important to me and I'm very passionate about, and that's instilling a collaborative product culture in a company. So we talk about feedback, but I think a great source of feedback can be internal in the company, depending on your size, of course. You know, my experience is mainly in small to medium businesses, but I think empowering everyone in an organization to be able to contribute towards the product development process and generate ideas is really great. Some of the best ideas we've had have come from really unlikely places. And, you know, shout out to my analysts in particular who I work with and on the Defense Insight product. You know, they're a fountain of ideas. Doesn't necessarily mean we have to actually implement them all, but I think empowering people to have a voice in the company not only makes them have a bit of skin in the game, it gives them that sense of they're part of the product development process, but also a lot of valid ideas come internally if they feel comfortable contributing that towards the product. So in my case, create a Trello board or whatever else you can use. Create an ideas board, you know, a template, which could be, who's this idea for? Why do you think it's important and what you're trying to achieve with it? And then I would go in there as a PM and then I'd validate that in terms of, okay, does this match to our value proposition? Is it really what our target market is interested in if it's external facing? And then move that along in terms of the backlog potentially, which I'll then further validate with like the RISE prioritization I'd mentioned. So how much impact is this going to have on our key metrics? How confident are we it's going to do that? And what effort or ease is there linked to that? So I definitely highly recommend allowing people to have a voice in the company to contribute towards product development, because it's not just the founder and CEO and the product team, which is the ideas or just sales handing over requests. I think that's something I'd like to drive into people.
Yeah. It's a fully integrated sort of thing. Yeah, that's for sure. If there's anything that you could leave with founders who may not have a product manager like yourself to be able to lean on, you know, if they kind of have to do it for themselves, is there anything else that they should be thinking about, or is there anything that we've discussed today that they should be sure to take away as they kind of, you know, venture into this perhaps, you know, new sort of world?
I think a big takeaway is just being guided by evidence and making sure that product decisions are based with data, you know, informed by data, driven by data, and understanding that all data also needs to be validated as well, because it can be misinterpreted. You might find that one set of data is saying one thing, another set of data is saying another thing. So I think that's the big takeaway, thinking with a product cap on. I think scrutinize your own prioritization and your own ideas. Yeah, any ego, let that go and think in terms of, is this idea good, both in terms of, is it aligning to our value proposition? And how much evidence do we have that actually this is going to impact our metrics as an idea? And also fail fast, you know, go through that pyramid, Dan Olsen's product market fit pyramid, get to the top, close the loop back with the customers and get validation of the idea, and then move back up to the top again and iterate. I think that's the key takeaway, I'd say.
Yeah. And that process really never ends.
And it never ends. Absolutely.
You can really keep refining and keep growing with your customers. Adam, such a great conversation, such a needed conversation, great perspective here. If people want to get deeper in your world, follow up with you, get connected with you, where's the best place to do that?
Sure. Yeah. So I have the podcast, the Product Development Podcast, which you can find on YouTube, as well as all major platforms on the audio. And also if you want to connect on LinkedIn, I'm found there as well. Adam-Wakeling.
Cool. We'll link that up in the show notes as well, so you guys can find it. And we appreciate you all listeners sticking with us. If you made it here, we would love and appreciate a rating or review wherever you get your podcasts. And if you know someone who's also scaling their business or in the midst of that journey, hit that share button and send them this episode. Let them know you were thinking about them. We appreciate you being here. We'll see you on the next one. Later, y'all.